Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Dan Coev on the unexpected consequences of religious favoritism in government.
The sociologist noted that it does tend to lead to a kind of lazy clergy. They don't seem to be very active in trying to reach out to their community, and they're content to have very small congregations because they're going to remain on their job, and the church is going to remain supported by the government no matter whether they have 200 people attending Sunday services or they have 20. And you tend to have mostly empty churches in some of these Scandinavian countries.
Dan Coev, next. Regent University professor Dr. Dan Coev, in his provocative piece, What Can Caesar Render Unto God?, among other things, says countries that show some sort of favoritism to a religion actually harm that religion. Spencer Dahlke is with Dr. Coev to get the details.
As a professor of government and criminal justice, was there a particular experience or something you observed in our culture that prompted the writing of this article?
So I think that there are two reasons that I became interested in studying this topic. One is autobiographical. I grew up as a religious minority in Bulgaria. I came from a Protestant Pentecostal family. Bulgaria is overwhelmingly an Orthodox Christian country. And so that's an experience that I had from an early age that made me think about government favoritism toward religion and what some of its consequences might be. Because there was always that sense that we were maybe like second-class citizens, viewed with a little bit of suspicion by the political establishment, by the media establishment of the country as I was growing up. Then I came to the United States. We immigrated back in the late 1990s, and I experienced a very different government-religion relationship that we have in the United States, where we don't have an established religion, we don't favor one Christian denomination over others, and we have this free marketplace of ideas. It was interesting to me that America seemed to be much more flourishing and thriving in its religious life than Bulgaria. And so that kind of got my gears turning about, well, why is it that the country that seems to stack the deck in favor of one religion is less religious than the country that lets it be something that society determines how religious we're going to be? And so that's the autobiographical part. The other part is the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a lot of discussion, even in the United States, where we have this tradition of no establishment of religion, of religious liberty. There's been a lot of emphasis on this idea of Christian nationalism. And obviously that's something that has its detractors who think it's a terrible idea and those who think it's going to lead us to the promised land. But all of that conversation has been, would that be good for our government, right? Would it be good for the government if we were to assert the fact that America is a Christian nation and have more religious influence in government? But I think the part that's missing from that analysis is, what is the effect on Christianity? So if you have that church-state linkage, I think it's interesting, what is the effect on government, but also what does that do to the church? That's why I went down this track of wanting to investigate this question.
In simple terms, it's a very nice study, but you know, in some ways it's quite academic. For the layperson, can you explain to us why it is, briefly, that government favoritism backfires and does not help the preferred religion flourish?
Let me just back up a little bit and explain, first of all, what I mean by government favoritism. So there are many countries around the world that will offer exclusive government funding to just one religious institution, or they might legally recognize in their laws or in their constitution, this is the official church. So the Greek Orthodox Church is the official religion of Greece, for example. You also have oftentimes government interference and intervention into the affairs of the church. And so sometimes you have political appointees making decisions in terms of doctrine and teaching, who gets to have what ecclesiastical offices. So that is all of what I mean by government favoritism. This intervention by government to try to boost one religion over others. The idea for that is, if we provide this type of government backing, that religion is going to flourish. It's either going to remain very popular with the people, or it's even grow in popularity. And we need that, otherwise this kind of traditional religion of the state will diminish. The problem with that, though, is that it creates a sense of dependency. So if the church is reliant on government for its funding, that disincentivizes contributions from members of that religion, right? People will ask, well, why do I need to give tithes if the government's already taking a part of my taxes to fund this state religion? So it discourages this whole attitude of volunteerism, of how can I donate my time? How can I donate my resources to help fellow members of my religion and to help the community? Well, the government's taking care of it, right? The religion is just a branch of government. It's kind of like the post office. So, you know, none of us go out and like try to volunteer to deliver mail. So why should I volunteer in my church if it's just like a government organization? But even among the clergy, if you think about pastors, how much of an incentive do they have to try to evangelize and bring people into the church? If they are just like civil servants, the way that they are, for example, in Scandinavian countries, in the Lutheran established churches in Denmark and Norway, if they're civil servants, they're on a fixed salary. If anything, they kind of have the incentive not to do too much evangelism and outreach, because that creates more work for them. That brings in more people. They have to offer more pastoral care. And so that's something, I didn't come up with this observation, but it's something that Rodney Stark, the sociologist, noted, that it does tend to lead to a kind of lazy clergy. They don't seem to be very active in trying to reach out to their community, and they're content to have very small congregations because they're going to remain on their job, and the church is going to remain supported by the government no matter whether they have 200 people attending Sunday services or they have 20. And you tend to have mostly empty churches in some of these Scandinavian countries. I think there are a variety of mechanisms. One is just kind of complacency and dependency on the government. The other one I mentioned is just government meddling into ecclesiastical affairs. So government telling churches, this is what you must decide on doctrine. And again, especially in the Scandinavian countries, government has often push them in a more progressive direction when it comes to social issues than the pastors and even the congregants in those denominations thought was appropriate. So pushing them more toward ordination of women and then acceptance of LGBTQ ideologies and things like that.
You mentioned Rodney Stark, and you talked about it in terms of the religious markets theory, I guess, the idea that, yes, if we see congregants as potential buyers of our religious wares, which it's an uncomfortable idea, yes, thinking of churches in terms of like markets. But is there a particular benefit to our churches thinking in terms of marketing a service? Like, and if there is, like, what would that look like?
I totally share your observation that it is a little bit uncomfortable. First of all, I'll start by saying that this is an idea that is not without its critics about whether that's really how religion works. Scholars of religion in Europe tend to think of it as a kind of unique American invention because we love markets so much and we're trying to apply a market paradigm to everything. And some will say, well, maybe that works if you're like a Californian and you just kind of choose religion from a menu, but that's not really how religious identities work in the rest of the world. So in most of the world, you're born into a particular religion, and then your identity changes very little, if at all, over the course of your lifetime. I kind of come in between these two ideas, one that completely rejects religious markets and one that completely embraces it. And I do think that there is something like fluid religious identity, not so much that, we're going to have people who grow up Baptist becoming Muslim, but, maybe someone who becomes Baptist later on becomes a Presbyterian. Or a Protestant or a Catholic in Latin America might become Protestant later on in life. So I do think we observe those kinds of fluctuations, and they are sometimes related by what is on offer by those specific denominations and those congregations. Whether that's like a good thing that they're competing with each other depends upon what they're competing with. Like if they're competing on which one gives the best coffee, or has like the best donuts before church, then that's not a particularly good way to kind of distinguish yourself and attract people. But if they're competing with each other in terms of which one offers the most impactful transformational teaching from the pulpit, Is it just kind of dead teaching that's kind of useless to the people? Or is it something that profoundly transforms? Do you confront people with the gospel? Do you encourage them to accept Jesus as their Lord and Savior? Do you challenge them to live in a more Christ-like manner? Do you just kind of tell them some nice stories and anecdotes? So if that's what we're talking about, if we're talking about something like how strong the teaching is or how effective the pastoral care is, how much you're doing for the community as far as volunteering, as far as feeding the hungry, reaching the unreached, that's the kind of competition that I think we should be very enthusiastic about as Christians. And it's the kind of competition that can lead to some churches growing at the expense of others.
I observed that in the course of your research, you studied 174 countries between 1990 and 2010, I think is the time frame you set. And that showed that like 70.6% of cases where there was an established religion, that favored faith actually declined relative to others. Did that surprise you? Could you walk us through maybe a standout example?
It did not surprise me. That was actually the hypothesis that I started with. To someone who hasn't thought about this a lot, it is probably surprising because you think the government is supporting a particular denomination. Well, sure, that's going to help them out because they can take that funding and they can, you know, build churches or they can reach out to people and try to get more converts and things like that. But it doesn't seem to be the case on average. And I do want to stress that it is on average, right? You do have those other countries in which it seemed to work, a little bit less than a third of countries where that support was beneficial. But more commonly, it seems to lead to disaffiliation with that favored religion. Really, the best examples of this, I've already mentioned the Lutheran churches of places like Denmark and then Norway. Sweden also used to have an established Lutheran church. Iceland still has an established Lutheran church. If you look back to the 1950s, typically you had something close to 100% of the population of these countries affiliating with that state religion. And today it's much closer to like 50 to 60%. And then if you look at who actually attends church, it's in the very low single digits. So not only do we have disaffiliation, but people aren't going to church. They don't tend to hold religious beliefs that are in accordance with that faith. And the few churches that have grown in those types of countries are maybe like non-denominational evangelical churches. And then religions associated with immigrants have also grown as well. So Islam and other migrant religions.
Why is it the churches grow due to immigration?
I think these are countries that have been historically quite homogenous, but in the past 20, 30 years, they have started to allow migrants, especially asylum seekers from the Middle East and from sub-Saharan Africa. Actually, it's really interesting that one of the causes of growth in Christianity in Europe is sub-Saharan African migration, because the people who are coming from countries like Nigeria, they tend to be far more religious. Also, they tend to have more children. So that's a big difference. You have the native European population tends to have a much more smaller family size of 1 to 2 children. Migrants tend to have more like 3, 4, 5 children. So that's also altered the religious demographics of these countries as well. Again, for Christianity specifically, depending where the immigration is coming from, that could mean growth, right? If it's primarily coming from Christians in sub-Saharan Africa, if it's primarily coming from Muslim populations in the Middle East and North Africa, then obviously Islam is going to be growing.
My guest today is Dan Koev. He's a professor of government and criminal justice at Regent University and the author of What Can Caesar Render Unto God? The Unexpected Consequences of Religious Favoritism in Liberty Magazine. You're contrasting places like Iran, where an established religion results in that religion tending to falter and people turning to private practices and things like this, versus, you mentioned South Korea, where it promoted Protestantism and, you know, the Protestant tradition flourished there. What factors is it that helps determine whether or not government intervention and its, you know, policies that favor one religion over another might help in some cases, but hurt in others?
That is a point that is worth stressing, that when I make this argument, in the article, it is an argument on average, and you absolutely do find those outliers. You mentioned South Korea under the military dictatorship there. Both Buddhism and Protestantism were promoted, and they seem to grow. Other examples would be the Romanian Orthodox Church. The Romanian state has funded the construction of new churches, and that's allowed some people who otherwise would have traveled too far to go to church to have a church nearby. That's increased religious attendance. So you do find those counterexamples. What sets them apart from the general pattern that state favoritism hurts churches? One thing is that a lot of the times these success cases are in countries that are already religiously homogenous. That is, they're not super diverse and pluralistic like the United States, where we have like hundreds of different denominations and all different religions, but you already have most of the population affiliating with the favored religion. So Romania, most of the population is Orthodox. And then, the same is true with Turkey, for example. That's another country where state favoritism seems to have helped, but Turkey is almost unanimously Muslim. So that way of picking winners and losers, I don't think would translate as well to the American case, where you have more dynamism and diversity in the religious landscape. The other thing I will say is these types of policies of government support tend to work best when you don't have overt government meddling in the affairs of the church. So government maybe provides like a block grant. Okay, you have this money, you can build a church with it so that you can serve people in an underserved part of the city. But we're not going to tell you anything about what you're going to teach on a Sunday morning. We're not going to tell you who to appoint as the pastor. That's your independent sphere as the church for you to make that call. We're just going to provide a little bit of material support. So maintaining the independence of the church from the government, to me, seems to be the most important thing to get state support right.
It does raise the question. We talk about the separation of church and state in our American tradition, which is valuable, but perhaps vague in the way that we talk about it as a culture. People on the left might, want no talk about God in our politics at all. For Christians that might want to see a government administration that is populated with Christians, that favors Christians, what sort of unexpected consequences might we not be thinking about if we start seeing that sort of religious tilt?
I actually have no concerns. And in fact, I would welcome to see more Christian influence on government. I would love to have more candidates who are open about their Christian faith and how that inspires them to pursue justice, to lift up those without a voice in government, to kind of embrace the Christian ethical tradition and translate that into policies. That's not really my concern. My concern is more about singling out particular winners and losers, especially specific denominations of Christianity. So basically saying, we're going to favor the Catholic Church, or we're going to favor Reformed churches, or whatever religious tradition might be. But I think government officials should be perfectly open about their faith. And I think we should really destigmatize talking about how our faith inspires us to create a better political system. I'm not even necessarily against the idea of government recognizing that we have a certain Christian heritage in this country, that Christian ideas influenced the founding. Even, I would say, all of Western civilization, in some respects, is the outgrowth of Christianity. Even something like the Western liberal tradition is something that's a product of Christian ethical teaching. And so some kind of government recognition of that, I think, is fine. Having like a cross somewhere on public land, for example. I'm not the kind of strict separationist that would say, well, you can't have that. Like, that's awful. I think it's okay to have it. But then you go to some extremes like Italy, for example. For a long time, they had a crucifix in every public classroom in Italy. And so, like, do we want to do that? And it's not just a cross, but it's a crucifix, which is specifically kind of aligned with a particular Christian tradition, like Catholicism. And how does that make feel kids who are not Catholic? How does that make a Jewish student feel, for example? where you think about the Jews and how historically they've kind of tried to protect their identity and not to kind of be blended in with Christianity, you know, for over 2,000 years. So I think we have to have a certain sensitivity to how that kind of like in your face display of religion might be perceived by religious minorities. And so for that reason, I think we might not want to go that far. As far as just making government statements that, historically we're Christian, Christianity has had this positive influence on who we are as a country, I'm perfectly okay with governments doing that. I think when we really get into hot water is if we do try to back one specific denomination over others, that's when we could really create dependency and complacency in that church.
I'm wondering, too, if you wouldn't mind casting a value judgment for us, and maybe this is a tough ask for someone conducting a study, but I'm just considering that when governments get involved to kind of enforce what you've called like this homogeneity among different cultures, not just the Middle East and Islam, but even in the 1600s and such, England had a lot of conflict over Protestant tradition, Catholic tradition, and trying to enforce homogeneity, a lot of violence. On the one hand, homogeneity does kind of lend itself to community trust. If everyone's like us, we tend to trust people more, a lot more community structure. And so in that way, diversity might kind of undermine that. But from what you've kind of been saying, it sounds like diversity also could be a feeding ground for, well, we were just talking about religious markets. You know, the church has to like actually step up its game and teach the truth in a culture of multiple different religions. What do you think about that? Like, it's complicated, and have we benefited from diversity?
I believe that we have. This is an excellent question, by the way, because I do think that homogeneity has certain benefits. It can create a greater sense of social trust, where we're more likely to trust people in our community if we believe that they're like us. They fundamentally share the same values. And there are all kinds of benefits that come through that, more political stability and better quality government seems to be associated with greater social trust. For religion itself, I do think that having some kind of competition is better because people do want a living and vibrant faith. They don't want a dead dogma. They don't want to just believe something because that's just what we've always done as a community. They do want something that's a kind of a transformative life experience that they can profoundly shape them. And I do think in the American system, where we've had this religious pluralism and competition for so many centuries now, that's exactly what has happened. So if you go back to like Thomas Jefferson, he has this statement that he wrote in a letter to a friend saying that in 100 years, every American is going to be a Unitarian Universalist, where it's this very kind of liberal religion that's super inclusive of very like ecumenical and doesn't really kind of take a hard position on anything. And 100 years later, we had hardly any Unitarian Universalists, but we had a lot of Baptists, right? So it's precisely those congregations that took more of a stand, that made more of a passionate argument. You know, it's the Baptists, later the Pentecostals, the non-denominational evangelicals, the ones that seem to offer something of greater meaning and substance to the people, they're the ones who increased in their numbers. And then we've also seen this decline in the mainline Protestant denomination since the 1950s and 1960s. And I think that's at least in part because they've tended to be a little bit squishy on areas of doctrine. And people don't like squishy. They want to have confidence in the truth of the Bible. So I do think that diversity, maybe it can undermine some aspects of government, and we have to think carefully about how to remedy that. But I do think it's generally good for the vitality of religion in the country.
Bringing it, I guess, to here and now for our listeners, specifically maybe those Christians who are called to enter the political sphere, it seems God has like constructed a world with different spheres of authority. How can Christian politicians bring the vibrancy of their faith and biblical principles into the political sphere in a way that honors church has its own authority, government has its own unique authority, both given to them by God?
I think the important thing for a politician seeking to do that and to do a good job of integrating their faith into their political career is to maintain that sense of distinction and not to subordinate their Christianity to their political affiliation. And that's a mistake that I see all the time. I see it on both the left and the right. I see it in Democrats and Republicans, is to basically start with the platform of the Republican Party or start with the platform of the Democratic Party and then try to find some biblical justification for everything that is in there. And that simply cannot be the way that a Christian, a thoughtful Christian, approaches their vocation as a politician. They have to start with biblical principles, and they have to reason from those principles, look at the issues of the day, and think about what would be a Christian response to this particular question. What is a wise and just and prudent policy based on Christian ethical principles? And then go with their conscience, right? Don't necessarily follow their party in everything that it does. Don't put loyalty to party over loyalty to Christ. You know, that's like easy to say and hard to do, because we have a system that tends to punish that. Any kind of disloyalty makes you a pariah, and you can lose influence. But you really have to walk that balance and make sure you're staying true to your convictions as a Christian and not subordinating them to political expediency. So maybe that's easier said than done, but that is what I think Christian politicians should aim to do.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Dr. Dan Coev, Regent University professor and author of the piece we've been discussing today, What Can Caesar Render Unto God? You can read it at libertymagazine.org. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's Ariana Molloy on Pursuing a Sustainable Calling.
A custodial staff member at a hospital that I interviewed felt like it was her job, her calling, to make that room clean for the next person that was going to come in with trauma. You know, an artist felt like it was their calling to illuminate someone else's understanding of beauty. A football coach that I interviewed felt like it was his calling to not only cultivate really good players, but good men. So that's meaningful work. Second is that you can identify a sense of caller. So there's a real clear sense of something, and as a Christian, I believe that to be God.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.